And this is KPCW. You're listening to the local news hour. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this weekend. We've got a report from Cedric Haynes with the ABC4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, Juneteenth. Wasatch back. It's going to be a hot one out there as we go throughout your Friday with a lot of sunshine and a few clouds popping up as we go throughout today. Temperatures will climb into the upper 80s for us in Park City. We'll be closing in on around 90 degrees in some spots. The Heber Valley, you're definitely going to be in the 90s. We're talking about temperatures in the low to mid 90s as we go throughout your high temperatures for today. Now, as we go into your weekend, it's a busy weekend, of course, as Saturday will feature mostly sunny skies, turning into partly cloudy skies. There will be a slight chance that we see a pop-up thunderstorm or two across the Wasatch back. Now, here's the deal. It's going to primarily be those dry thunderstorms, which will be feature more gusty winds and some lightning strikes as opposed to beneficial rainfall, but that chance will be there, so keep an eye to the sky as we go into your Saturday afternoon. Those clouds will help to actually cool temperatures down just a tad, so we'll be looking at high temperatures only around the 80-degree mark in Park City for your Saturday. We'll see those highs in the mid-80s in the Heber Valley. Father's Day arrives on Sunday, but not before the summer solstice, early Sunday morning at about 2:42 in the morning. That's, of course, when the Earth's axis is tilted directly towards the sun. That gives us the longest amount of daylight in the northern hemisphere. So we're going to be looking at those sunsets after 9 o'clock, well after 9 o'clock on your Sunday. And that means we're going to be looking at over 15 hours of daylight. Compare that with the winter solstice, where we're going to be talking about only about 9 hours of daylight. Either way, Sunday also is Father's Day, and it's looking pretty good with lots of sunshine, a couple of thin clouds, temperatures around 80 degrees again for Park City. We'll see those highs into the low to mid-80s for the Heber Valley. As we head into next week, you guessed it, another ridge of high pressure builds in across the area as we go throughout the week. So that is going to guarantee more dry conditions across the region and temperatures that will continue to warm through the week. So we'll start off with those highs in the mid-80s there in Park City, climbing to near 90 by the middle of the week. We'll see those highs near 90 to start in the Heber Valley, climbing into the mid-90s by the middle of the week. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'm going to be speaking with Justin Jones. He's the executive director of the Gary Herbert Institute for Public Policy at UVU. We're going to be talking about election security. Then I recorded an interview yesterday with Professor Paul Reeve. He's a professor of Mormon studies at the University of Utah. We're going to be talking about Juneteenth as it pertains directly to Utah. And then we'll finish our hour by speaking with Timpanogos Valley Theater board member Gary Hart about the upcoming production of 1776. Stay tuned. The developers of over 800 homes in northern Heber City want to use public infrastructure districts to pay for parts of the project. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports city council members had mixed reactions to that proposal.
The Highlands is a community of hundreds of homes planned near the Utah Valley University Wasatch campus, north of downtown Heber. Construction began in fall 2024, and developers hope to finish building by spring 2028. To help the project along, developers are asking Heber City leaders to allow them to create three public infrastructure districts, or PIDs. The PIDs would be able to issue bonds to pay for things like roads, utilities, parks, and 67 affordable housing units. At a meeting June 16th, they estimated infrastructure costs will be $40 million. If approved, the PID's debt would be repaid by property owners who buy homes within the Highlands. Councilmember Yvonne Barney says if the PIDs aren't allowed, the developers estimate each home will be tens of thousands of dollars more expensive. With the PIDs, the base price of the home could be lower, but buyers will need to pay extra fees.
They feel that with the PID, it will decrease the overall amount for each of those units by $40,000. Their presentation was that in using the PID, it will help them to keep these homes attainable and also enable them to put in strong infrastructure for their community.
Barney says she's aware of some of the concerns about using PIDs to spur development in Utah.
There's been the concern with the failed community in Colville, and we also know that the Utah State Auditor's Office has been extremely loud, if you will, when it comes to their disapproval of the PID system.
Barney says PIDs don't allow for good government oversight, and in the case of Summit County's Wahali, the project's failure has led to lengthy legal battles. Barney is encouraging caution with the Highlands application.
For me, I just am not sure that this is a good way to go.
Other council members were more supportive, like Sid Ostergaard.
We have already two that we've approved. Most recent is Harvest Village or The Slope. So I'm for it. It adds benefit and it adds value to be able to get stuff and this missing middle slash affordable housing product out there sooner than later.
The PIDs don't have council approval yet, but another discussion is set for July 7th. Mayor Heidi Franco asked the developers to come back with more detailed cost estimates. She worried the lower home prices might not outweigh the added PID fees.
We need real numbers. But even the discount that they get up front is not going to last through their mortgage. And it is going to be very expensive for median range income or even our affordable units that you're talking about to be able to pay those property taxes.
Council members also asked to see the park and trail designs and other potential public benefits. The city annexed the land for the Highlands in December 2021. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
While a Summit County reigns in nightly rentals, regulators say they can't police every neighborhood in the county. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports each city makes its own rules.
Summit County has drafted additional regulations for short-term rentals, potentially to include bans in certain neighborhoods. If new regulations go into effect, they'll only cover unincorporated areas. Code Enforcement Officer Scott Buchanan tells KPCW his office doesn't have jurisdiction within city limits. However, Summit County's new short-term rental hotline often receives calls from within Park City proper. Buchanan has previously said code enforcement does not want to discourage residents from calling, since it can be difficult to tell where city limits begin and end. After all, everyone's mail in the unincorporated Snyderville Basin still says Park City.
Once I receive them, if I see they're out of the area, then we just make sure that they're moved along, and I speak to our counterparts over in Park City about it.
Park City Municipal has its own nightly rental complaint form. Code enforcement forwards calls from within a city or town, including east side municipalities like Camas or Colville, to that municipality during regular business hours. Similarly, noise complaints are forwarded to the Summit County Sheriff's Office in case deputies need to respond. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City School District has again hit pause on adjusting Friday release times. KPCW's Christine Weller reports a survey shows that elementary parents are split on the issue.
A Park City School District proposal to adjust Friday release times for the middle and elementary schools has stalled after mixed survey results from families. Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman said as proposed, the school day would have ended 20 minutes earlier for the four elementaries and 35 minutes earlier for Ecker Hill Middle School students.
The survey gave us a nuanced picture. This isn't a situation where the community is clearly voting in one direction.
The results prompted the Board of Education to delay a decision on the proposal at its meeting June 16th. It was first considered in May. Nearly 850 parents and guardians responded to the survey, including 450 from Ecker. Over 60% of Ecker families said they support earlier release times on Fridays. But parents with kids in elementary schools were split, with 35% in support, 38% opposed, and 27% neutral. Huntsman said the change was proposed in part to help bus drivers. They need 40 minutes between elementary, middle, and high school end times to get to each school. The change would also give teachers more preparation time.
One of the themes that emerged as we did a listening tour at each school site this year was our staff needs more time, and this was a way to give them more time, especially on Fridays, since that was a structure that already existed.
While many respondents support more teacher planning time, most were also concerned about taking away instructional time. Parents also wanted evidence prep time would be used effectively, and dual-income families said pushing elementary start times earlier would make childcare difficult. Huntsman said a decision on changing Friday release times will be delayed until later in the year, after more community feedback. If a change is approved, it wouldn't go into effect until the 2027 to 2028 school year. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Primary ballots for various elections around Utah have been mailed out to voters across the state. On the phone to discuss election security and a special study commissioned by the Utah legislature is Professor Justin Jones. He's the executive director of the Gary Herbert Institute for Public Policy at Utah Valley University. Welcome back, and thanks for joining me, Professor Jones.
Thank you for inviting me back. Appreciate it.
Okay, Professor Jones, I want to start with a little bit of background. Utah has had vote-by-mail for a while. When did Utah adopt the current vote-by-mail system?
Yeah, in 2012, the legislature allowed counties to begin using a vote-by-mail process. In fact, in 2013, they were able to, some counties adopted the process. But by 2019, all counties started using vote-by-mail as the preferred or the, you know, the way we all end up voting for our people running for elected office or for other issues.
And at the time it was first put into place, was there some effort made to safeguard the integrity of the system from the beginning?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, they were working very hard from the very beginning to make sure they'd learned from other states at this point. Other states had been doing vote by mail for some time. And of course, as a state, we've been doing a modified version, or essentially for our military personnel who are wanting to participate, they've been doing a version of vote by mail for decades, absentee ballot, right? And so the idea was that we'd learn from those experiences and then scaled it up county by county. It wasn't something that the state adopted just overnight. It was done in a very methodical and thoughtful process over a period, say, from 2012 to 2019. And then, of course, in 2020, COVID, everybody voted by mail.
And since that time, have there been any confirmed instances of election fraud associated with the mail-in voting process?
There have been. Definitely, there have been. People have intentionally tried to defraud or fraudulently vote. People have received, you know, moved in from the time that they received a ballot at one house, moved to another and got a different ballot. But those, in most cases, have been caught. The process in validating and counting the ballot, they've been able to catch those instances. Now, are they 100%? Not likely. But the impact of actually changing the outcome of an election, we believe, has never actually taken place. So any of this fraud that has been discussed hasn't necessarily adjusted or changed the result of an outcome, having one candidate lose their election, for example.
Your team has evaluated the mail-in system in the past. Can you describe the steps that your team took to really understand the process?
You know, it's a wonderful opportunity. At the Herbert Institute, we work with faculty who, you know, have studied these things. Both, we've worked with our math professors as well as our political science professors, and they involve students. So we're not experts in elections, but what we have done as sort of a fresh set of eyes, evaluated the policies, the practices, the procedures that our elections officials use to not only to manage the entire elections process, getting the ballots in the mail, making sure the voter rolls are up to date, making sure that when we do submit our ballots that they are received. It's easy to submit your ballot. It's easy to vote. It's accessible to the right people. And then also to tabulate those elections results. What we found is that the policies and procedures are good, that they that there's always room for improvement. And I think we see that almost every legislative session where bills are introduced and debated and passed or fail, depending on, you know, the process. But ultimately, there isn't a perfect system for this. But Utah has a really good system. We're really confident in the process, the procedures, when followed, that Utah has a safe and sound elections process.
And let's start with the front end. The first step is registration. What does Utah do to safeguard the registration process?
Yeah, you need to use, basically, you do need to show your ID, and you go to the driver's license division, obviously, and you bring your birth certificate and, you know, two forms of ID, your valid driver's license. part of the process, of course, is that you have to validate that you're an American citizen and that you're eligible to vote. And so we work hard for that. Now, is that the perfect system? No. But again, it's the best we have. It works for all of our other identification purposes. And then recently, on our ballots, we all, as you fill out your mail-in ballots, you'll note that you put, you know, you sign your ballot, which also is a process of verification. If your signatures match, then your ballot is good. But you're also adding the last four digits of your Social Security number or driver's license for an additional measure of security.
And then you also obviously have made observations about the process of counting. And from time to time you hear, you know, stories in the press or particularly in social media about skullduggery during the counting process. Talk a little bit about what you observed and how there is visibility into the counting of votes here in Utah.
One of the things that I think has been phenomenal is meeting with our clerks across the state and how open they are to allowing people to come in and take a tour of the ballot center to understand and to actually be getting, you know, even right now, but particularly on election day on Tuesday, the 23rd, you can literally go to the your county clerk's office or their ballot center and watch as poll workers tabulate and process everyone's ballots. They do try very hard to make it transparent. They want people to be engaged. I know for myself, every time I've gone to a ballot center and watched and seen how methodical and how careful our county clerks and their staff have been, I've left more and more confident in the system. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't errors, but they do everything they can to avoid making errors and to make this a trustworthy and good process.
If you Google sort of voting fraud in Utah, you'll find these allegations of voter machine fraud. Have you seen any evidence of that, and is that something you guys have looked at?
We're looking into it during this study that the legislature has asked us to do out of the last legislative session. We're looking at not only whether the machines, you know, that they do use will work. I will say, as we've watched it in the past, that they test the machine. They have a set of ballots. They know the outcome of these ballots. They, put it through the machine. And if the machine gives, you know, the correct tabulation, then, you know, the machine's working. They test it, they retest it, and they post-test. I think that, typically what you've seen is, yeah, machines break or machines air out, or there's the process, you know, the poll worker doesn't use the machine or, you know, correctly. But there are safeguards and checks for this and ways to go through it. And we're confident in most cases that the machines are in good working order or they're not used.
So you've mentioned the legislature. Remind our listeners, what did the state legislature ask you guys to do, and how is that process going?
Yeah, primarily they've asked us to evaluate Utah's vote-by-mail system. So is there a way for us to, is it safe? Is it secure? Is it doing what it's supposed to do, which is basically taking the vote of the people and tabulating those votes and making sure that the right people are elected or the right issue is voted on. We're evaluating that. We're evaluating the security of and the ability by comparing other states and their systems of voting. Some states are a vote in person only. Others are, you know, a vote by mail and vote in person. We're comparing other states. So we plan to go to Georgia, Tennessee, Colorado, Arizona, Washington. We have appointments with their state elected officials as well as county clerks and others. Arizona, some of these other states have had issues with voter mm-hmm. fraud, but they've learned from them, and we want to understand exactly and compare Utah's system with theirs. I think there are some in the legislature would like to see us do away with our vote-by-mail system, and others are saying, no, please don't. What's the cost if we were to go back to the days when we all showed up at the elementary school and voted on one day? The fact is, that's not necessarily going to happen mm-hmm. going forward. We, you know, elementary schools and schools themselves are like, it's too much for us, you know, so where would we do that? So there are lots of different things we got to consider when we think about the the pros and cons of our vote by mail or vote in person process. So we're taking a look at all of that. We don't have any preliminary findings, of course, yet, but we plan to have our report wrapped up later this summer, early fall, and report in October to the legislature.
So your goal is to report prior to the November elections?
That's correct. That's what we're required to do by HB 377.
And, you know, as an academic, I imagine this is kind of fun. Tell us a little bit about how many people are on the team, and are some of the students getting a chance to participate in this?
The fact is the students are doing much of the work. We have five really brilliant students who came to us interested in this, and of course went through a process. But they are so dedicated to figuring this out. So they're working basically close to full time over the summer to do the research, talking with, interviewing. We're interviewing legislators, county clerks, visiting. In fact, this next few days they'll be in ballot centers across the state, looking at how ballots are tabulated, mm-hmm. and understanding the process, and particularly understanding the cost, the cost benefit of doing it in vote by mail. You have places of our state, you know, in San Juan County, where it's literally to be hours to drive to the county clerk to submit your or to vote in person, where, you know, the vote by mail is really a more accessible process for them. And not just that, say Grand and others, you know, throughout our rural part of Utah. So they're taking a look at all of this, and they're really having an exciting time just digging into this fundamental part of what, you know, being an American citizen is all about.
Yeah, I would imagine this is part of as vibrant and stimulating an experience for students as you can get for those interested in political science. I mean, I envy them. I never got to do anything that much fun when I was an undergraduate.
It certainly is exciting for them to be able to put this paper, I think, at some, you know, on their resume and say, hey, take a look at what I got to dig into. And actually, they'll be presenting to the legislature later this fall, and we're really excited. They're doing phenomenal work, and they're asking really smart questions, which I really admire.
So, Professor Jones, there will be a report submitted to the legislature in the fall. Will that be public, that we'll all be able to look at it?
No question. We'll be presenting, if invited. We're asked to give a report to, I believe it's Government Operations Subcommittee of the Legislature. We'll do that. If they ask us to present, of course, it's fully accessible on the legislature's website.
And I can guarantee that you will be invited to come back and discuss that report with us in the fall. Professor.
Oh, we'd love that.
Okay, Professor Justin Jones, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you.
Today is the Juneteenth holiday. On the phone to share with us a bit about the history behind the holiday and some tidbits about Utah's own history on the topic is Professor Paul Reeve, the Simmons Chair of Mormon Studies in the History Department of the University of Utah. Good morning, Professor Reeve, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
So, Professor Reeve, let's start with a little bit of background. While I know the Juneteenth holiday has been around for a couple of years, not everybody understands what it's all about. What is the Juneteenth holiday commemorate?
The Juneteenth holiday commemorates June 19th, 1865, when Union troops arrive at Galveston Bay in Texas and basically announce to the enslaved people there that they are in fact free. So freedom actually takes Union troops to ensure that freedom is realized. And for those in Galveston, Texas, even though the Civil War had been over for over 2 months by that point, it takes Union troops arriving to enforce freedom. And so that comes to be enshrined and remembered as Juneteenth.
And when was the proclamation signed? In other words, what was the time gap between when President Lincoln signed the proclamation and the Juneteenth?
Well, so the Emancipation Proclamation goes into effect January 1st, 1863. But you have to remember the Emancipation Proclamation does not free enslaved peoples in states that were loyal to the Union. It only frees enslaved people in the Confederacy as an act of war. Lincoln believes he has constitutional right to do this because of war powers. But remember that the Confederacy doesn't recognize him as president. And so Really, it's only where Union troops are present and have freed significant areas of the Confederate South that enslaved people are, in fact, set free. So it goes into effect January 1st, 1863, but in practice, it varies across the Confederate states by simply the presence of the Union Army.
Was Texas sort of the last frontier in terms of when this information got out, in terms of slaveholding states and territories?
Yes, I mean, that's why we have this whole Juneteenth, because, you know, enslaved people themselves are left out of any sort of communication network. Right. So there might be underground kind of networks where word is getting passed around, but, you know, they're not getting texts about this. And it takes the arrival of Union forces in Galveston, Texas on June 19th, 1865 for the enslaved people to have the assurance of freedom or to even be aware that they have been freed. So. Yeah, that's a part of what's going on here. But it's important to remember then the rest of the states that might have remained loyal to the Union, they wait until the 13th Amendment to the Constitution is passed. And that's ratified in December of 1865. So that finally outlaws slavery everywhere. The Emancipation mm-hmm. Proclamation only in states that were in rebellion against the United States.
So let's talk about the holiday. When did the sort of Juneteenth become, the notion of creating a holiday around Juneteenth start to come together?
There have been people like Opal Lee in Texas who have been advocating for this for a number of years. There are groups who, especially African-American civic groups or a variety of other groups of that nature, who have celebrated Juneteenth, but in terms of a national holiday, Opal Lee is a community organizer, leader in Texas who was advocating for this and finally came to fruition in 2021 when President Joe Biden signed it into law.
And are there sort of commemorative events going on around Utah for the that you're aware of for the holiday?
You know, I think they're mostly community based, mm-hmm. And so it would be a matter of, I think, checking in with local, city and community based organizations. Largely, people celebrate through picnics or community-based organizations that might commemorate the events at the end of the Civil War. This is, a second freedom for the nation. Abraham Lincoln defines, the Civil War as a new birth of freedom, finally resolving the great American paradox that a nation founded on principles of liberty and freedom simultaneously countenances the enslavement of human beings, and the Civil War finally reconciles that, and the 13th Amendment outlaws enslavement. So, sort of memories of that get commemorated, but now it's nationwide where we are celebrating finally the eradication of slavery.
I want to talk a little bit about slavery in Utah. I mean, most of us, when we hear the term slavery, we think about slavery in the 19th century. We think about the cotton industry and the way in which so much of the nation's economy was tied up with the use of slave labor to generate cotton. That I don't think we grew cotton in Utah, but there apparently were some slaves. Let's talk about a little bit about how slavery came to Utah and when.
Yes, slavery arrives in Utah, or African-American slavery arrives in Utah on July 22nd, 1847, 2 days ahead of Brigham Young's arrival in the Salt Lake Valley. There were three Black enslaved men who were sent ahead by their Latter-day Saint enslavers as a part of Orson Pratt's Vanguard group who are the first to arrive in the Salt Lake Valley on July 22nd. They camp around 50 East and 1700 South that first night, and then move north and are plowing and planting by the time Brigham Young arrives on July 24th. The state of Utah today commemorates Brigham Young's arrival, but it's important to remember that the first Vanguard group arrives 2 days ahead, and that includes three enslaved men, Green Flake, Oscar Smith, and Hark Wells. And two of them are baptized Latter-day Saints. So their white Latter-day Saint enslavers send them ahead to provide, to build shelter and plant crops so that when the white enslavers arrive the following year in 1848, they will have a place to live and food to eat. So slavery arrives with the Vanguard group of Latter-day Saints in the Salt Lake Valley. There are also forms of indigenous slavery taking place that Latter-day Saints are also drawn into pretty quickly after their arrival. So it's here from the beginning. African-American enslavement is here from the beginning. And then other Latter-day Saints who are converts to the faith from the South will bring their Black enslaved with them over the next several years into Utah territory. The most who are present at any one moment in time that historians can verify are 56 enslaved people. A contingent go to help establish San Bernardino in California in 1851. So for most of the next decade, between 1852 and 1862, between 30 and 40 enslaved people exist in the Salt Lake. Well, I shouldn't say just the Salt Lake Valley, but in Utah territory. Mm-hmm.
So was the I guess the territory formally would be considered a slave allowing jurisdiction, right? I mean, I guess it was legal.
Well, the legislature, the territorial legislature, passes a law in 1862 designed to define the legal relationship between white enslavers and their Black enslaved. And the law that they pass is distinct from chattel slavery as practiced in the South. The question that is animating the nation and dividing the nation ultimately will not be solvable except for the loss of 600,000 lives and a civil war is, can human beings be held as property? And Northerners tend to say, no, that's a violation of the founding principles of the nation. And Southerners say, yes, in fact, they can be held as property and the Constitution protects our property rights. You cannot strip us of our property, including human beings. So the law that Utah passes does elevate the enslaved people in Utah territory above the condition of mere chattel or property. It grants them some rights, but it frees no one then enslaved. It does not pass on the condition of servitude to the next generation. If you're born to enslaved parents in Utah territory, we believe that the law that is passed does not pass on that condition to the next generation. So over time, it could be seen as a conservative form of gradual emancipation. It does grant enslaved people some rights. It requires them to be educated. In the South, you could not be educated. It was against the law in the South. Utah law requires it. It says you cannot, an enslaver cannot sell their enslaved to another enslaver without their consent. If you have consent, you're not property.
Mm-hmm.
So there are aspects of Utah's law that elevates them above the condition of property. But like I said, it does not free anyone then enslaved. You have to understand in the 19th century, there are a spectrum of unfree labor categories. Mm-hmm. We tend to think in the 21st century of only free and enslaved. There are apprenticeships, there are indentured servants, and the law defines those who are enslaved in Utah as servants and grants them some rights, but does not free anyone.
Now, at the time, was there any kind of sort of moral debate going on within the church and the church-related governing bodies about the morality of slavery?
Absolutely. There is a protracted debate over this bill that passes in 1852. It's called an Act in Relation to Service. And one legislator who was also a Latter-day Saint apostle. So there's the overlapping of religion and politics in the territory, who says, okay, I don't care about the fine distinctions. Any method of unfree labor is in fact slavery. And he proposes that the bill be rejected outright and tells his legislative colleagues that if they pass this bill, it will be enough to cause the angels in heaven to blush. That man is Orson Pratt. Brigham Young, you know, is in a debate with Orson Pratt, and theology gets mixed with politics as these two men debate this. But probably the most significant outcome of Orson Pratt's position is that after his very animated anti-slavery speech, the bill is modified. As originally drafted, it would have passed the condition of servitude on to the next generation, making it perpetual. That clause that would have passed the condition to the next generation is removed from the bill. It's crossed out and isn't included in the final bill. Therefore, we believe the intent is that those who are born into to enslaved parents in Utah Territory do not inherit the condition of their parents. Therefore, similar to free womb laws being passed in Mexico at the time, that if you are born to enslaved parents, you don't inherit their condition. You would have been born into freedom. So, yes, there is a very heated debate over this bill in territorial Utah. Orson Pratt doesn't win the day, but he does have influence on the shape of the final bill.
So I want to talk a little bit about, you know, how sort of the Emancipation Proclamation, the sort of the notion of the slaves being free, how was that communicated to and reacted to here in Utah?
Yeah, so this is separate from the Emancipation Proclamation. So most people are just not aware that this even existed. But on June 20th, 1862, Abraham Lincoln signs into law a bill called an Act to Secure Freedom to All Persons Within the Territories of the United States. Mm-hmm. So remember, the Emancipation Proclamation governs those in rebellion against the states in rebellion against the United States. This law is passed for those who exist in territories, not states. And Utah is a territory in 1862. And as such is subject to congressional rule. And so the Republican Party, when it's first founded in 1856, founding plank in its presidential platform is that Congress has the right and imperative duty to prohibit in the territories the twin relics of barbarism, slavery and polygamy. And Congress and Abraham Lincoln make good on that promise when Republicans are in control in 1862. They pass a law prohibiting polygamy in the territories and a law prohibiting slavery in the territories. So in according to the law, then Utah's legal Juneteenth is June 20th, 1862, really ahead of the rest of the nation in terms of the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment. The challenge is, how do enslaved people find out about that, right? So for Juneteenth in Texas, it requires Union troops to arrive. We don't have the arrival of Union troops in Utah. The only evidence that we found of an announcement of this law that is passed is published in the Deseret News in July of 1862 on page 4, buried in the middle of a column titled From Washington. There are no banner headlines, no big announcements, yay, slavery is over in Utah Territory. It's really buried in the middle of a column on page 4 of the Deseret News. So as historians, it's really difficult to ferret out when do enslaved people learn that they have been freed in Utah Territory. And it's very possible that they may have had to have waited until the end of the Civil War in 1865, the passage of the 13th Amendment in December of 1865, even though the legal end to Utah, to slavery in Utah, would have been June 20th, 1862.
I have to ask, given that it sounds like there was not a lot of publicity surrounding this, was there more publicity surrounding the polygamy ban, which might have been a little bit more of a significant issue here in Utah?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, Latter-day Saint leaders are concerned about that, and they will spend the rest of the 19th century pushing back against the increasingly stringent laws that are passed against polygamy, and won't capitulate until 1890 when the federal government attempts to confiscate Latter-day Saint temple properties. So that has its own history, but yes, they are much more concerned about the passage of the anti-polygamy law in 1862.
So I take it when you try to trace what happened to those few slaves that were remaining by at this point in time, it's really hard to figure out when they were liberated or how they were liberated or what happened to them. The chain just sort of runs out.
Exactly right. Frustratingly, they don't leave a written record. We do have one formerly enslaved man who is interviewed by a Black-owned newspaper in Utah at the end of the 19th century. So, you know, his recollection is impacted by memory. Sure. And he doesn't specify how he first learns. He says, you know, we were all very enslaved people in Utah Territory were very excited when we learned we had won our freedom through the fortunes of war, which, you know, if you're reading contextually, might indicate that it might have been the end of the Civil War by the time they learned this. And as historians, we could find no evidence to indicate maybe that enslavers are responding to the 1862 law that Lincoln signed into law. So it's just an open question. June 20th, 1865 is Utah's legal end to slavery. In practice, how long does it last? And we don't know.
We've been talking with Professor Paul Reeve, the Simmons Chair of Mormon Studies at the University of Utah. Professor Reeve, thanks for helping us learn so much about Juneteenth and for spending the time with us this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
We'll be right back after this.
Well, the Timpanogos Valley Theater is about to celebrate the upcoming Independence Day holiday with a production of 1776. On the phone to tell us about it is Timpanogos Valley Theater board member and 1776 cast member, Gary Harder. Good morning, Gary. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having us on for the opportunity.
So, Gary, before we get to 1776, can you share a bit about the Timpanogos Valley Theater Company? Where's the theater, and what kind of productions do you guys normally do?
Well, I'd be happy to. We are located in downtown Heber City, 50 North, 100 West, and we've been in existence. We're in our 21st year. We've been at that location since 2010. So 16 years now, and a great partnership we have with the city of Heber. It's an old social hall that was built in the early 1900s. It's had many purposes through the years. It was a place to gather. It has a sprung floor. We shored that up when we moved into it. And while it creaks, it doesn't bounce. And we've been able to do a lot of family productions through the years, and we're a family-friendly community theater. We have a place where actors can come and those who want to work behind the scenes on tech or directing, producing, are just assisting. And we get a lot of people who have never been on stage before, and they're able to come with us and act with people who have appeared off Broadway that are part of our organization as well. We have programs we do for the community, adult. You know, mostly adults are in those. And then we have a youth theater as well that does number of performances through the years, typically in the early winter, early spring. And right now we're doing some boot camps, two-week boot camps is what we do through the summer with it. We have an improvisational comedy group that's part of the theater, and they perform the second Saturday of every month. They've been in existence now for quite a while. It's a lot of fun, family friendly, And we're looking really forward to this production of 1776 that we're ready to open on next Wednesday, the 24th of June.
So how many shows will you typically do a year, counting the youth theater? I mean, it sounds like there's something going on there most weeks.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because there is. There's many things going on. We'll do upwards 9-10 productions, somewhere right in that ballpark yearly. Like right now, we have the 3 boot camps, and we have 1776, so there's 4 of them right now. We've already done a couple other youth theaters. This next youth theater coming up, we're going to do 2 boot camps of Newsies Junior, and they're in July and early August. We'll have those. Then we're doing a Broadway Under the Stars in September for a 2-night performance. And they're a number of them are folks who have worked with us through the year, but also open to the community to come in. And if they have a talent that they'd like to share in singing, we hold auditions for that. And that's mid-September. We're doing War of the Worlds, the Panic broadcast. Mm. And that is, if you recall, the old 1930s when they actually did it. Yes, it's turned into a radio play. We've typically done radio plays over the last 4 or 5 years in December, but we're going to bring that forward, and we're going to do that now for October, getting ready for Halloween, mm-hmm. and that's the latter part of October, the War of the Worlds. We set that up. We build a 1930s, 1940s-looking radio set. We have Foley artists, all the whole shebang, and microphones on stage, and people come up. The actors come up and they do it just like they did it in the Orson Welles version that you mentioned as well. Then we're coming right back in, and we're going to do for our December play, it's the best Christmas pageant ever. And that'll end on the 19th of December. And then we get ready right away for our spring and, you know, our spring seasons. And we're going to be doing Peter and the Star Catcher and a number of other things that we'll do in the spring of 27. So 8, 9, 10 performances. Wow. And then with the Belvedere's on top of that, the comedy group, improvisational comedy group. And then a number of groups rent our hall to do other performances as well. So you're right. It's a very busy theater. We have a lot of great performances and a lot of great interaction for people throughout the Heber Valley. And we got a lot of people come over from Park City and work with us as well. So,
and are all the performers amateurs, or do you have some paid people for some of these productions?
No, we're all non-paid. We're not on equity with it. We have some who have been previously in other productions, certainly. Yeah. But ours are unpaid volunteer performers, if you will, mm-hmm. For it. But it's a lot of fun. We build all the sets. We're building the set right now for 1776. Like I said, we have great folks who help us out, great partnership with the city, the TAP grant that we get from the city, and so we apply for those from the city and for Wasatch County. We have great support for other private donors for us as well, and just a lot of people dedicating a lot of sweat equity and making sure these productions and the performances are good, but that the people who participate in them have a tremendous experience as well. My family, we've been involved in the theater now 20 years. So when we moved up here, we needed something. We were looking for some things to do. My wife found Timpanogos Valley Theater. We did the first play with them 20 years ago, Music Man. And we've been involved in one capacity or another. And my wife, Trudy, she's our board president. And as you mentioned earlier, I'm on the board as well. I take care of the facility. And then every now and then, get up on stage like this one.
And let's get to that before we run out of time. Why did you choose to do 1776? And tell us a little bit about the nature of that production.
It's a great production. It started on Broadway in 1969, and it talks about the days leading up to the writing of the Declaration of Independence. Starts in May of 76, concludes on the 4th of July. And it was a partnership with the city of Heber for their 250th. We have 25 or more men, boys, guys on stage, big voices. I play Benjamin Franklin. We have John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and representatives from all 13 colonies. And it gets you a very good understanding about the struggles and what they were going through and the compromises. And these men who were very, very successful in their colonies coming together with a lot of different competing ideas and thoughts, and to break from the British crown, continue with the British crown. And it comes on to the dramatic ending of the signing of the declaration by all involved. And it's a tremendous play, really ripe for the 250. The America 250 celebration that we're on right now.
Lots of musical numbers.
Yes, there are. There's music through the whole thing, and a dialogue certainly that gets you to understand some of those compromises and tensions and support and tensions sometimes within the delegations that goes on to make the decisions and for everybody to vote. Very dramatic climactic ending. We know what it's going to be, but it's great to see it enacted on stage. So we open on the 24th of June. We're doing 8 performances. We close on 4th of July with an afternoon performance. We'll start at 2 o'clock with that. And you can go online and to find, we're on Facebook. You can find us if you'd like to get tickets. Performances will start at 7 o'clock in the evening. Some people have probably seen the movie that was shot and that was done in 1972, but it was Broadway in 69, and we go from there as well.
Gary Harder, who will be playing Ben Franklin in the upcoming production of 1776. Gary, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, our website is timpvalleytheater.com.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Coming up on the community campfire right after the NPR news, they will visit with paragliders Kevin Lant and Mitch Riley, who frequently fly over Park City's mountains. They'll find out what's ahead in local sports with Skinny on Sports. And, of course, there'll be an in-studio music performance for the campfire music sesh. Also, Amber's going to sit down with Rachel Chase, a Midway resident finding joy in sharing her powerful story of resilience and connection. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.